In this episode, we speak with Jake Heller, Head of Tech Growth Equity Americas of KKR. Prior to joining KKR in 2019, Jake was at Spectrum Equity, where he focused on growth investments in software, information services, and internet businesses. He started his growth equity career at Symmetric Capital and also spent time as a strategic consultant at the Parthenon Group in their global private equity practice. Jake served 4 years as a commissioned officer in the United States Navy and finished his career in naval special warfare as the commander of a high-speed assault boat team. He is a decorated veteran of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom, including the Bronze Star with distinction for valor in combat. I'm your host, RJ Lumba. We hope you enjoy the show. If you like the episode, click to follow.
RJ Lumba is the managing partner of Growth Cap and the executive chairman of Market Insight Media. He is the host of Growth Investor, a podcast featuring today's best investors, executives, and founders. In the minutes ahead, we'll uncover insights and strategies for accelerating growth and succeeding in business.
Jake, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today. It's a delight to be with you.
RJ, thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
I always like to try and start somewhere interesting. One thing about your background that caught my attention was that you were a detachment commander in the Navy. I did some research trying to figure out what the role entails. You did it for quite some time, several years. For the benefit of our audience, can you describe that position and what you did for the Navy?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So the detachment commander is a reference to the special boat teams in the Navy. And for folks who may be a little bit less familiar, naval special warfare is really broken down into two groups, the Navy SEALs and the special boat teams, otherwise known as special warfare combatant craft crewmen. And after I'd spent a little bit of time in the fleet, I got selected to go into naval special warfare, and I was assigned to the special boat teams. So I was the detachment commander of what's called a Mark V detachment. And what that means is I had two boats, a number of special warfare combatant craft crewmen assigned to me. The boats were called Mark Vs. Well, Mark V is now retired, which makes me feel old. But the Mark V is just what it sounds like. It's a high-speed assault boat. It's about 82 feet long, 17 feet wide, 100,000 pounds, twin 235 horsepower jet engines. And the primary mission is the insertion extraction of special operations forces, be it Navy SEALs. It could be other special forces units within the United States military. It could also be international forces that we had a chance to work with over time. And so my job was to be the overall mission commander for any of the activities that we were engaged in. And that sort of evolved just given the time that I was in teams. And our, you know, primary partners and all that were the Navy SEALs, and I was deployed with SEAL Team 3.
Yeah, I think it's particularly admirable given, you know, you had graduated from Harvard. It may not be a typical path to go do what you did. What was it that led you into doing that for 8 years or so?
So, you know, to be honest, it was really just about finding a way to pay for college. I had dreams and aspirations of being a scholarship football player in college, and turns out I wasn't good enough for that. So I was, you know, looking for different ways to pay. I came from a place called Brockton, Massachusetts. And when I was on a trip to one of the colleges, I met with a Navy recruiter who told me about the ROTC program. And in pretty short order, I was lucky enough to be awarded a Navy scholarship, and then I was accepted to go to Harvard. I did have an amazing experience on the Harvard football team. But with that, ROTC scholarship was the requirement and the commitment to serve 4 years on active duty and 4 years in the inactive reserves. And so it was a lot, you know, in college in terms of the extra requirements, required an extra class every semester. And at the time, ROTC had been kicked off campus. And so I had to take all my Navy classes and training at MIT. And then upon graduation, I was commissioned as an ensign or an O1 in the United States Navy and served on active duty for 4 years. And that was in June of 1999. And then again, spent 4 years on active duty, primarily stationed in San Diego.
I imagine much of your experience, you know, within the Navy and within your roles plays a part in how you operate day to day, even in business and in investing, in competitive situations, in building out a team. Maybe that others may not have the benefit of, you know, that kind of background. Can you share with us a little bit about maybe things that you've taken from that experience?
Absolutely. And RJ, I think you're exactly right. You know, again, for a lot of reasons, those are such formative years coming directly out of undergrad at 22 years old. So they're formative years in general. And then, you know, I think a military experience in any way is a very formative experience. And I fortunately happened to be in at a really unique time in our country's history. So, you know, when I initially got in, it was sort of fairly peacetime where our military had been administrative for a long duration. But I was off the coast of Pakistan for 9/11 and then was forward deployed for operations in Afghanistan and the war in Iraq. And so what is a formative experience otherwise became incredibly formative. And so I think for me, it was an incredible experience, one of the penultimate experiences of my life, maybe other than having children, that helped shape the way that I think about leadership and management. And people come into the role that I'm in today in all kinds of different ways, some more common than others. And I don't like to over-glorify the experiences that I had or over-dramatize the experiences that I had in special warfare. But what the only thing I would say is it just gives me a different perspective. It doesn't necessarily give me a better perspective. It's just a different one than potentially having come through a more common path. And that different perspective, I think, informs two really important parts of the job. And it's two things that we think about and we talk about a lot here. It informs my perspective on partnership with the world's best entrepreneurs in growth technology companies. It informs my perspective in the best of times and in the challenging times. And I think it informs my perspective around leadership and management and the culture that we're building within our growth team and building upon that KKR has established over a half a century. And so, I mean, it's just the little things, and it's always about the little things. But when it comes to partnership with teams, you know, it's a very ingrained notion that it's never as good as you think it is or as bad as you think it is. It's things like plans rarely survive first contact with the enemy. It's the importance of having a plan and being flexible enough to deviate from it and keeping a low resting heart rate when challenges arise. And they always do. And then internally, you know, it's about a fundamental recognition that anytime you walk into a room or anytime you get into a newer environment, regardless of the age, rate, rank of anyone who happens to be in that room before you, they know something you don't. It could be, you know, what I always joke around about is it could be they know where the exits and the bathrooms are, but it's something you don't know. And, you know, the opportunity to look at individuals like that and try to extract that information in the best way possible, trying to recognize and respect and understand versus humility over arrogance. And I think that's a big part of what the, you know, military experience teaches you. It's certainly a big part of what special warfare, special operations, special forces teaches you. And so that's one, you know, example. And then the second, you know, in the internally facing vector, a maniacal focus on the personal and professional development of the people who are making the commitment to come work with you and work for you. You know, I think that's a hallmark of my leadership philosophy and what it is that I'm trying to create here. But it really came from working with an entirely different subset of folks in the earliest days of my career.
So fast forward now many years, and you're at Spectrum Equity. It's like 2019. You decide, I believe that's the right year, you decide to move over to KKR. What prompted the move? Did you head right into a leadership position at KKR?
It really was about the leadership position. Spectrum Equity is a fantastic place. They too have been around for a long time, founded in 1994, so going on 30 years now. And I had a great experience and a great almost 10 years. So it was about 9 years that I was there. And I had a chance to learn from extraordinary investors and great people. So I wasn't looking for something different. I wasn't looking for a change. And the opportunity that came in was to come here and help contribute to and build something new, build a great franchise. And Spectrum has a great franchise. They had great leadership and have great leadership across the folks who are running that firm now. And the opportunity for me was really to step in with my two partners, Dave Welsh in San Francisco and Steve Shanley in London, and help them build this. It seems a little bit counterintuitive because KKR had been around for so long, but the strategy at that time, the growth technology strategy at KKR, was fairly new. And so the opportunity was to come in and sort of roll up my sleeves and help build this franchise on or under the flag of KKR on the platform that this firm had built over decades. And so it was really that leadership position that was exciting to me, the opportunity to come and do that. And that's really what we've been up to. I've now been here for 5 years. The strategy is 10 years old now. We're on our third fund and continuing to execute with, you know, a culture that we're passionate about, a strategy that we're passionate about, and creating what we think is a real reference model for a scalable and repeatable franchise going forward.
And how does it work within the overall organization? Do you operate almost as a separate entity? How merged or integrated are you with the overall operations?
So the only thing that is separate is our fund. The only thing that's really separate in terms of, you know, how we think about it, what our mentality is. So we have our fund three is a $3 billion fund that we're investing out of. We just raised in November of 23, so less than 6 months ago. And so we have a team that's purpose-built to execute against a growth technology strategy that Dave, Steve, and I have all spent our entire careers around. But when it comes to how we execute, when it comes to how we, I think, partner with companies, we are critically integrated with the rest of KKR. And that truly is our reason to exist and our right to win. When our strategy was formed back in 2014 timeframe, the last thing the world needed then was another growth technology firm running around, and I would suggest we need it even more less now. So our reason to exist and right to win was that we could take everything that KKR had built now over a half century and bring them to the category leading, category defining, category disrupting companies in growth technology in a way that no one else can. And so It's leveraging all of those resources at KKR as a way to create inflection points, accelerate inflection points, minimize execution risks. And what we talk about is redefining the concept of value for our portfolio partners. What's critical is it's not just words on the page or marketing material. What backs that up, one, is the culture that Henry and George have built and now Scott and Joe are leading. But what's more important is we are all compensated out of one single pool of carry. And so, you know, the deals that our team does in growth equity benefit the partners and the investors on the industrials team in Asia, the real estate team, you know, their deals similarly were compensated on. And what that generates and creates and is supported by the culture is a real sense of urgency around helping people across the globe. So we are very tightly integrated with other folks. And we really think, you know, again, from our foundation of a strategy, one of the things that really differentiates us is our global reach. And that's across industries and geographies. And it's all the companies in this growth technology sector that is affecting everything else that KKR is doing. And similarly, we think that everything else that KKR is doing is giving us and gives us a really interesting perspective into the next software solution, the next product, the next business. And we really leverage that. And again, we think that gives us a right to win.
And how do you define what's considered growth equity? And then the second part to that question is, can you share with us one of the deals that you've done that kind of exemplifies growth equity?
Sure. So, and again, especially, you know, sort of in the last 3 years, growth equity has been confusing. What was formerly, you know, pretty defined series A, B, and C, you know, I feel like the alphabet has been on speed, especially in the 21 timeframe. But for us, growth equity is clearly defined as a business with real scale, real products selling into real end markets. And I'll define that a little bit further, but that means we don't take product risk and we don't take market risk. We start talking to companies. We have a proactive origination strategy. We've got a team of extraordinary young people who are accessing entrepreneurs very early in their journey. And we start talking to companies when they're $5, $6, $7 million of revenue. We start getting really excited about those businesses from a partnership perspective when they're reaching 15 or 20 million of revenue or ARR. And then, of course, some of our businesses are well north of 100 million. And so for us, we think of growth equity as, again, you know, established businesses with real products selling into big end markets that have demonstrated they've crossed, you know, a threshold where product and market risk are behind them. They're in the rearview mirror. And then from an investment strategy, again, not atypical from a lot of players in the space, we're agnostic when it comes to minority or majority. Control means very little to us. What we're looking for in, you know, category leading, category defining companies is violent alignment with management teams and existing shareholders. And so historically, you know, north of 70% of our investments have been minority investments. And again, we actively look for, you know, opportunities to work with earlier stage investors, whether that be to provide them some liquidity or just to provide them additional primary capital to continue to grow whatever business they may be in. And I would say also with respect to growth equity, most of our businesses are growing north of 30% at the low end. And some of our businesses, you know, are growing well north of 100%. But that's sort of how we think about it. We really clearly try to define the difference between venture capital, where, you know, you're taking a lot of bets on very early stage companies, often with or without a product, maybe revenue, maybe not. And certainly, you know, the later stage buyout folks who are, you know, often achieving their returns through, you know, some growth, but also financial engineering and leverage. So we're really right in the middle of that. And again, our returns are generated by growth, both the top line, margin expansion, and ultimately, you know, real profit generation through the life of the hold. Mm-hmm. And I could give you one example of a business that I think sort of fits well in that profile of mine. And I think there's a lot in our portfolio that we're fortunate to be able to talk about. But there's a company called O9 Solutions, which is in the supply chain demand planning, integrated business planning space. And it's a good story on a few different levels. But the first is it really played into some themes that we love. The first is that the chairman of that company and the CEO of that business, Sanjeev Sidhu and Chakri Gudumakala, both grew up in supply chain. They started and worked at a business called i2, which really was the next generation supply chain software company in the late 80s and 90s. Took that company public, it ultimately ended up being acquired. And they sat out and thought, what would it take to really build the next generation software solution? A true single instance, multi-tenant, cloud-based platform to disrupt industry. And not only disrupt the industry, but our chairman, Sanjeev, has a true global goal. And I think it's consistent with what supply chain optimization can really do across much more than just helping getting product onto shelves. The business was bootstrapped by Sanjeev, Chakri, and their partners. So they'd not taken any institutional capital. Very hard to get in touch with them, which we love and is kind of a hallmark of our businesses. But ultimately, what we really got conviction about, one, was the legacy and the history of Sanjeev and Chakri and their team. And then secondly, with no institutional capital, no outside capital, they were able to knock down the blue chip premier customer in every vertical where they dipped their toe. And today, you know, amongst their customer ranks, there are companies like Walmart, Starbucks, AB InBev, Nike, L'Oreal, ExxonMobil, et cetera. And it truly was become, and we believed they had the best solution in the space, fighting against a bunch of legacy players. So the likes of SAP or another company called Blue Yonder, Kinaxis, and then a sort of more of a newer, more modern company, but not specifically focused on supply chain and Anaplan. And what they're doing is demonstrating extraordinary ROI, extraordinary return on investment, saving their customers real dollars. There's a large telecommunications company that came out with their own internal white paper that showed O9 saved them $1.5 billion. And again, as we think about looking at companies and diligencing companies outside of their own P&L, we think about the engagement and the net revenue retention, the positive net revenue retention that their customers demonstrate. And O9 now has, I think, 6 customers that are paying more than $10 million a year for their platform. So we got really excited about that one. We were in a small, non-banked, but very competitive process to be their first institutional investor. And what was interesting about that one is we signed the term sheet, I believe it was a Thursday night. I think it was either March 11th or March 12th of 2020. So staring headlong into COVID. And I think there were some things we knew, and to be very honest and humble, there were some things we did not know at all with respect to what COVID was going to bring. What we did know was that, and we had deep conviction that O9 had the best platform in the industry, a platform that was poised to disrupt supply chain demand planning. What we didn't know was that, you know, the incredible exposure that COVID was going to provide for the dysfunction of the global supply chain. And in that regard, I think we got fortunate there. We've since continued to invest in the company. We brought on 2 great partners in General Atlantic and Generation Investment Partners. And we're continuing to back and support a great management team, work with and partner with a great chairman in Sanjeev. And we think there's a lot of fun and interesting opportunity in front of that business.
That's an excellent example of how you invest, how you partner up. I'm wondering, for the benefit of the CEOs listening out there who may not currently have an investor, but is contemplating it, how would you best differentiate your approach versus other growth equity firms out there?
You know, I'll focus on us and try to talk about what we talk about and how we think about partnership. And the first is, I tell all CEOs and entrepreneurs that I do not have the Midas touch. And if they're looking for the Midas touch, I usually recommend Twitter because it feels like everybody on Twitter has the Midas touch and maybe easier to do after the longest bull run in the history of the modern US economy. But instead, what we do have are two things. One is access to the KKR platform. And so when we think about the kind of company we're looking for, we break it down into a pretty simple explanation. It's a business that sits at the intersection of two critical themes. The first is category leading, category defining, category disrupting. Good news, bad news, everybody else is looking for that too. The second axis of that intersection is every bit, if not more important to us, which is, can KKR help? Can we leverage all the things that our firm has aggregated over the last 50 years as a way to redefine the concept of what it means to be a value-added partner? And so it's our global reach with offices in, I think now, 23 cities and 16 countries, our network of strategic advisors, our internal consulting operating group called Capstone, our capital markets team that helps our portfolio companies across the entire capital raising journey, all the way up to pre-IPO readiness and training. It's our people inside of KKR, folks like Henry and George, who still come to work every single day and are passionate about the companies that we're investing in and want to work for them, want to pick up the phone, want to leverage their experience and their networks. It's folks like General Petraeus and Ken Melman, both my partners here, who I work very closely with at times. We're looking for companies that want access and exposure to those resources. And we're trying to use them to redefine what it means to be a partner. And the commitment that we're going to work as hard as we can to deliver. And we have a pull, not push mentality. So we don't, you know, sort of come in and tell people what they need or tell portfolio companies what to use. Instead, we try to give them a menu of available resources with the fundamental recognition that their needs and the challenges and the opportunities are going to evolve over the life of our hold. So sometimes it can be real in-depth work with one of our strategic advisors around pricing or go-to-market, or it could be real work with our Capstone team in thinking about post-merger integration, the 180-day plan, the agendas for those first meetings about how to bring two cultures together. And that continually changes and evolves. And we think one of our most fundamental roles on the board, and this sort of gets back to some of the stuff, some of my military experiences, the most fundamental thing we can do on the board is listen. The most fundamental thing we can do is listen and help think and see around corners and then expose the company to the resources that others have built and aggregated over time. And so that's how we think about partnership. And that's how we think about our differentiation in this highly competitive world with a bunch of great investors and great firms around us.
Last two questions. One is, can you tell us about a person who has had a profound influence on you?
And I know you always ask this question, so I've sort of been thinking about it. And I'll, like other of your guests, I'll name two, and I'll try to make it quick. The first one, I know you hear a lot, but I would say my father for sure. But I specifically a profound influence in every aspect of my life. But in this job, he was also my first real coach when I was a kid, coaching Little League Baseball. And there were two things, two sort of foundational philosophies that he had when he was coaching Little League Baseball, which is he would tell the kids all the time, you've got to ask yourself, what am I going to do with the ball if it comes to me? And I love that philosophy and that mentality of how to be prepared and how to think and visualize and mentally prepare yourself for whatever might come your way. And then the second, and I'm sure this, he didn't come up with this quote, but I always attribute it to him, which is, you know, fundamental leadership philosophy, which is put people in positions to succeed and catch them doing great things. And he's said that to me since I was, you know, a young kid, and it's core to my foundation here. And it sort of bleeds into the second person that I'll mention, which is one of my first captains in the Navy, a guy by the name of Rick Rushton, And this was before I got into special warfare. I was in the fleet, which means I was on a big ship, a guided missile cruiser called the Antietam. And when I first got there, we had the lowest morale in the Navy. I think the highest suicide rate, 400 sailors on the ship. And it was tough. It was tough living. It was tough operating. And Captain Rushton came in as our new commanding officer. And I saw the impact of extraordinary leadership. I saw what a person can do to make change. And it was still the same ship. It was still all the same people. The interesting thing about the Navy is that it's a little bit like Little League baseball. There's no trades. There's no free agents. You can't give bonuses. You got to take the people you have on the field and put them in positions and hopefully catch them doing great things. And what Captain Rushton did in a lot of ways was, number one, taught me the importance of engaging with humans, of engaging with the whole self, not cogs in a wheel, talking to people and telling them not just what the job is, but why they were doing it, and then telling them how great they were doing at it, and taking young people and pushing them into the spotlight, pushing them into places that they may be uncomfortable, but not without the air cover they needed to succeed. And this was in an era that I won't go into too much detail because I said it'd be quick, but this was coming out of the zero defect Admiral Rickover Navy, where you did not get promoted if you made mistakes. You did not get promoted to take chances. And I think one of the things that he did intelligently was encourage young people and put them in positions to really learn and grow, whether they are young sailors or young officers in the Navy. And so the impact of leadership at a very early and formative time in my career has been impactful to me. And it's some of his lessons that my team is probably sick of hearing about, but I repeat and try to lead by here in our group at KKR.
Last question. Can you tell us about a charity cause or other endeavor that you're passionate about?
Outside of my kids, which is probably, I'm pretty passionate about everything that they're passionate about, and it evolves over time. So my hobbies kind of become theirs. But outside of that, with respect to charities and charitable organizations, I like to focus on anything that is aiming to take care of not just our soldiers and sailors, but our families, particularly the ones who have deployed overseas. And so, again, I had, you know, some of my most important experience in the Navy and special warfare. So organizations like the Navy SEAL Foundation are, again, organizations that are committed to the families of folks who have made sacrifices or the ultimate sacrifice in the defense of our country is where I, you know, have a particular passion.
Excellent. Well, Jake, I want to thank you again for taking the time. This has been a wonderful conversation.
RJ, thank you. It was a great honor to be here. I'm humbled to be amongst the group of incredible people that you've already had on this program. And like I said, it's a pleasure.